Joining us right now is Jock Bartley. You all know him and love him, the lead guitarist and vocalist from a group called Firefall. And I love the music of Firefall. Great stuff.
Well, thank you very much. We do too.
Well, you're still playing it.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, I probably wouldn't have kept it going all of these decades and years if the songs weren't so strong and so good. And I'm happy to report that from the response we get from crowds and the airplay we still get, that our songs are still standing up today as the well-thought-out, well-crafted, meaningful songs that we think they are.
Well, I kind of agree. You know, there were some songs in the 70s that, and actually even later than that, stuff that like the Eagles did, stuff that you did, stuff that Bread did, that really I still think sounds fresh now.
Yeah, I agree with you. And in Firefall's case, I think we were extremely lucky that pretty much from the first month of rehearsal, long before we made our first album, we sounded like us. We sounded like the Firefall to be with that combination of musicians and didn't ever try to have to find what our sound was.
Hmm.
And I'm sure probably the Eagles and Little River Band and, you know, kind of did the same thing, but I know a lot of bands really struggled to find out what they sounded like. And we were fortunate enough to have really good songs to play, and then with the combination of the musicians that we had, it all just seemed to come together, and we had a whopping first year in 1976.
Mm. Let's talk before that about growing up. You were born in Hutchinson, Kansas, and moved to the mountains of Colorado.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a little bit about growing up, and also, when did you start in terms of getting a music education?
My mom was a musician and an arranger, a vocal arranger, and played a number of instruments. So I grew up, gosh, from infancy, you know, listening to Beethoven and listening to records and singing, you know, kind of folk songs and stuff. And when I lived in Kansas, I took a year or two of piano lessons that did not take. And my family, when I was 8 years old, moved to Colorado, the mountains above Colorado Springs. And my mom, I saw in a Sears catalog a red guitar with a little amp that you could probably buy for like $59 then or something. And I went, Mom, I want that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And she was smart enough to think that that guitar may not be a really good instrument. It was more like a toy, and did a little shopping around the area and was very fortunate to find that there was a very world-famous jazz guitar player named Johnny Smith, who was a Gibson guitar endorsee and had been the Downbeat's top guitar player of the year award for a couple years in the late 50s, had just dropped out of the New York jazz scene and moved with his new wife to Colorado. And I was, the best thing that ever happened to me really was that I became one of his first students, and the only student that he took that was as young as I was, which was 8 years old, and man, I had a wonderful musical upbringing playing, you know, by the time I was 11 and 12, I was playing Duke Ellington and Bach and all this stuff. And then I remember when I was a freshman in high school, I heard Eric Clapton and B.B. King play on record on the same month, and those two things changed my musical life. I said, man, I want to do that. I don't want to read off of paper and, you know, and play what everybody else writes for me to play. I want to play from the heart and the soul, and like Eric Clapton does, and that pretty much changed my life.
Now, I guess when you went to high school, you were a really good student, and you played basketball as well, right?
Well, yeah, I was a jock, I was a basketball player, and I was a student council guy, and I was, you know, I tried to excel in all kinds of things, which kind of, some sort of psychological makeup of me of trying to get, you know, people's approval and, you know, and I don't know, I've been in counseling a long time to try to figure out my whole early years and stuff. But, yeah, I was a really outgoing type of person, and I learned really early on that the best thing I did in this world was play guitar, and I'm also a pretty good artist, and, you know, and when it came time to figure out whether I was going to do art for a career or do music, it was a real easy decision. But the interesting thing about that is recently I've been really pursuing, you know, as a 50-year-old guy, my art career and painting in earnest, and I'm currently being shown at an art gallery showing in Vail, Colorado, featuring the art of John Lennon and Ronnie Wood of the Stones and Grace Slick and others, and I feel incredibly honored to, you know, to have my paintings and stuff. So it almost comes full circle for me, because back when I was 18 years old, it was a very easy decision to, you say, I'm going to do music full time.
That's interesting. I mean, with the name Jock, you'd think you might have gone into sports.
Well, I wasn't tall enough to play, you know, to think about playing college basketball.
Yeah.
I was a scorer, you know, and I liked to shoot the ball. I played terrible defense, but boy, I could shoot.
Another Pete.
And,
another Pete.
You know, but I knew being 5'10", it was like, nah. You know, as soon as you got into college, because I kind of grew up in, you know, small town Colorado, Manitou Springs and stuff, and it was, you know, I was really good on our basketball team, but had I been in a really large high school or, you know, heaven forbid, big college or something, I would have just been an average player probably, and particularly not a very tall one. So, no, music seemed like, I think I pretty much knew from about the time I was 10 or 11 or 12 exactly what I was aspiring to do with my life, which was play music.
Now, when you went and you left college, where did you land? What was your first gig?
Well, I was in a number of bands in college, in Boulder, Colorado, and at that time, when I was a freshman in college, the Colorado band Zephyr, featuring lead guitar player Tommy Bolin, were just getting going and were the rage, and was one of the first Colorado bands to get a record deal and start touring around the country. And about a year or two after, I only went to CU for 1 year and then pretty much dropped out and started doing music full time. And lo and behold, Tommy Bolin quit the band Zephyr, went on to bigger and better things for a brief time before he died in, I think, about 1975. He was in the James Gang and Deep Purple.
Right.
And I replaced Tommy as lead guitar player in Zephyr, and we made Zephyr's third album, Sunset Ride. And that band wasn't, you know, destined to go on too long. And after that kind of split up, I totally by accident fell into being hired by Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris and the Fallen Angels. Graham, who had pretty much revolutionized the American Beatles, which were the Byrds, and on the Sweethearts of the Rodeo album, Graham's influence really took them in a country or country rock direction, which, of course, you know, a lot of people attribute Graham Parsons with having pretty much invented country rock, which later bands like the Eagles and Poco and, Manassas and Firefall and a lot of those kind of bands came from.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got to Boulder, of course, when they made their record, James Burton from Elvis's band was the guitar player. He, of course, was locked up with Elvis and couldn't go on the road. Clarence White, who had been in the Byrds, who was an unbelievable player, wasn't available because he and Roger McGuinn were doing the Byrds, so they hired an unknown guitar player that Emmylou knew from Washington, D.C., and on their first gig, which happened to be in Boulder, Colorado, the guy, unfortunately for him, was proven to be out of his league and was not a very good player. And they put the immediate feelers out, is there a guitar player in town who can step in and, complete the band The Fallen Angels? And the manager of the club knew I was in town, knew I was a hot player, knew I didn't have a gig, called me. I went down, auditioned the next night, and, I got hired. And two or three nights later, from having fallen into this band, and I had known of Graham Parsons from the, some of the stuff, and I was a huge Byrds fan, three nights later on our second gig in Houston, Texas, here we are playing on stage, and Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt come in and sit in with us.
Whoa.
It was the first time Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou ever sang together, which was, God, talk about, a privileged honor to have been in the same room when that was happening. And in the crowd that night were Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, who Graham knew from hanging out with the Rolling Stones, because Graham, was instrumental in taking the Rolling Stones, in a kind of brief country direction with Wild Horses, and, he influenced them in an American country kind of Americana way.
Right. Angie was another one that he was involved.
Yeah, and I mean, so it was just being at the right place at the right time, which, 99% of deserving musicians and songwriters and singers, are waiting for the big break, and unfortunately they really never get that big window of opportunity that might take them into the big time, and they spend their whole life playing at Holiday Inns or something, and it's just kind of sad that a lot of times that it all boils down to either who a total luck type of situation, or being at the right place at the right time, and that's, in my case, what it was. I was at the right place at the right time, and I was ready. I was a good player. My chops were up. If the window of the opportunity opened up for me and I was out of practice and wasn't playing good, I would have missed it.
Hmm.
And so I got hired, and then here I am 2 days later. 3 days earlier, I couldn't pay my rent. I was painting apartments to, pay my rent, with the landlord and stuff. And 3 days later, I'm on stage with my hero, Neil Young, and Linda Ronstadt.
And then, it's talk about, coincidences and things that happen. You don't know why, but in New York City, shortly thereafter that, you met Rick Roberts, who was from Boulder.
And small world, I do believe in fate, and I think things happen for a reason, good and bad, and it's all a learning experience in our life and stuff. But Rick Roberts is who Chris Hillman got to replace Graham Parsons in the Flying Burrito Brothers after Graham left.
Right.
And, so here was Rick playing the night after Graham and Emmylou and the Fallen Angels played at Max's Kansas City in New York City, and that's where I met Rick, and we talked a little bit and said, oh, you live in Boulder? Cool. Well, I'll look you up when I get home, and blah, blah, blah. And Graham, after the tour, Graham went back to L.A. and recorded the Grievous Angel album with all the Elvis guys again. And I wasn't needed on the record. I went out to L.A. to find out if they were going out on the road again and if they needed my services and stuff, and it was that same night when we found out that Graham had died out in Joshua Tree, and the whole thing crumbled, and Emmylou was totally devastated, and, within a few months found herself on her feet, in Nashville trying to get a solo career going, which, of course, has been a huge success.
Right.
I went back to Boulder going, wow, and looked up Rick Roberts, and he had, after quitting the Flying Burrito Brothers, Ricky had written the song Colorado, which Linda Ronstadt had made famous. There's a Flying Burrito Brother version of the same song.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking to either he'd made two solo records to moderate success. Joe Walsh had produced one. He was looking to either make another solo record or form a band. And he and I got together and started working out some of his tunes. We heard about Mark Andes, the ex-bass player from Spirit and JoJo Gunn. And Mark and Rick and I started getting together and jamming and thinking, man, this could be really good. And Rick said, hey, I know a great songwriter-singer that nobody's ever heard of yet in Washington, D.C., Larry Burnett. And he played us a tape of Larry's, and the first song that played was Cinderella. And Mark and I looked at each other and went, get him out here. And Ricky sent him a plane ticket, and Larry came out, and bam, we had two really great writer-singers, Rick and Larry. And Mark and Jock were the two really accomplished players, Mark on bass and me on guitar and lead guitar. And we got a local drummer who didn't really work out, and Rick knew about Michael Clark, the drummer from the Byrds and also Flying Breeder Brothers, who was driving around the Great Northwest in his VW van without a gig, and we called Michael, and he drove down to Colorado, and suddenly we had a five-man kick-ass band. And from the first day of rehearsal of the band that would become named Firefall, we had 30 original songs to play. So that was, I think, the best thing. You know, really great chemistry and great combination and stuff, but we had wonderful songs to play from the get-go.
Now, where did the Firefall name come from?
Rick thought of it, and for anybody out there listening who's ever tried to put a band together, it's actually harder to find a name that is good that everybody likes than it is to write songs and work them out and, you know, and play the music. We were going through the name search. We had our first gig in Boulder booked, and it was like 2 or 3 or 4 weeks out, you know, and the people that were going to make up the posters were saying, well, what's the name of the band? And we're going, I don't know. And Ricky's throwing out names, and everybody's kind of throwing out names, and it was a very short list of anything that stuck. And he said, what about Firefall? And we kind of looked at him and went, Firefall? And he said, yeah, you know, and we went, well, I guess, yeah, put it on the list, and it ended up being the best thing on the list. He had known the Firefall back in the 1950s, and there's some pictures of it on our website, www.firefall.com. They used to, on Yosemite National Park in Northern California or Central California, every summer, I think it was on Tuesdays or some odd day of the week, they would set a big, huge bonfire up on off on top of this cliff, and slowly in stages, they'd have this plunger push over the bonfire, and looking at it from below, it looked like almost like a lava flow or a volcano, and they called it the Firefall. And it was a big tourist attraction, and it was very famous out on the West Coast. And incidentally, that I heard not too long ago, a few years ago, somebody said, oh, I saw the Firefall, and every time before it started, they would have this guy come out, you know, and there'd be people parked all around, and you know, there'd be hundreds of tourists going to be watching the thing, and he'd come out with a megaphone and go, let the fire fall! And then they'd push the thing off the mountain, and it was spectacular. And it looked, you know, like I said, it was like a molten waterfall, and Rick had heard that name, and it stuck, and so we said, well, okay, I guess we'll be Firefall. So from our first gig, we were called Firefall, and we only played pretty much Boulder and Aspen for the first year. We were lucky enough because of people like Michael Clark from the Byrds and Mark from Spirit and Ricky from the Flying Burrito Brothers that we were kind of elevated status over just a regular club band. And we had our sights on a record deal and getting a demo tape and trying to shop to record labels from the get-go. And it took us about a year and a half to make a demo tape, which Chris Hillman graciously produced. And Warner Brothers paid for the tape. And when we finished it, we sent it to Warner Brothers, and they kind of went, nah, we pass. It surprised us because we thought it was really good. And as soon as we were on the open market, Atlantic Records gobbled us up and signed us up. And we then at that point realized we needed a keyboardist, hopefully saxophone, flute player. And Rick knew David Muse from Clearwater, Florida, that he grew up in high school with. And we got David out and went into rehearsals with producer Jim Mason and worked out the songs for the first album, and then went down to Criteria Studios in Miami to record them.
Now, I understand that while you were recording this, that you looked in the control room and Eric Clapton was in there.
That's almost correct. In fact, one of my moments, you know, when somebody asked me, well, tell me two or three of the highlights of your career, Jock, and definitely one of them was, so on that first album of Firefalls, which we made in the winter of 75, and it came out in early 1976, my moment as the lead guitar player to shine was on the song Mexico, on Rick's song Mexico.
Right.
And on stage, that was the last song we'd play at the night, and it was just, you know, balls to the wall, and just everybody loved it, and I got to just go out on whatever limb, you know, I got to. And if you went back in my personal history, like in fact I said 5 minutes ago, when I was taking lessons from Johnny Smith, everything I read was off paper, and I was getting really good and playing all this jazz and classical stuff and being groomed to be the little next jazz prodigy. The instant, I heard about this new band called Cream. I thought the name of the band was Fresh Cream because their first album just said Fresh Cream on it.
Right.
And I looked at it and I went on. I bought the album and I put it on. And when the first song on the album was I Feel Free, and the solo on that song, the first instant I heard that, it was like the light went on and the heavens opened up, and I said, that's what I'm supposed to do, you know, which was the Eric Clapton's solo on that was just so soulful and so unthought out, and just, you know, and I, you know, so then I went to try to find everything on Eric Clapton I could, and then I discovered John Mayall Blues Breakers album featuring Eric Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of that, he's sitting there playing an old Cherry Sunburst Les Paul and a little Fender amp, and, you know, fast forward 10 years or something, here's Jock in Criteria Studio playing a Cherry Sunburst Les Paul and a little Fender amp and getting ready to play the solo of the hottest solo that I was going to probably play on the record. And I went in to play it. I'll try to make the story short. I went in to play it. Was all warmed up. You know, the producer said, you ready? Yep. He pushed the red button, started playing. I was playing good, sounded good. Played, you know, and they had just added the horn section on the solo in the middle of the song the day before, so I'd never played around the horns yet. So I'm playing, and here comes the solo, and it's like, where are the horns? Oh, there they are. And I'd stop, and then I'd play, and then I'd stop, and I'd play, and then I played it out. Ended up being a one take thing, and when it was done, the producer said, "God, that was great. Come on in." And I went, "Well, wait a minute. You know, the solo and the horns. I'm not sure it was great. I know you've got the tracks. Can I have just another pass on the solo? I think I can play it better." You know, here I'd been preparing 2 years for this solo on Mexico,
right.
And after 3 minutes it was done, and I wanted one more crack at it. And he said, no, come on in. And I went, come on, let me do it. No, come on in. So I kind of got a little upset, and I took my guitar off, and I walked in the control room to say, give me another pass. And when the door opened, the first person I saw was Eric Clapton, who had been watching me the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
My hero, and, you know, and I just kind of crumbled and became Jackie Gleason, you know, ha ba 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 ba. And it was a moment I will never forget, and he stood up and, you know, shook my hand and said, keen playing man, and walked out, and I just slumped in the chair and was just, you know, and the one-take solo that I had played while my hero was watching, unbeknownst to me, stuck on the record, and that became, you know, the solo that everybody, you know, kind of, you know, became familiar with. But it was pretty amazing. And I guarantee you that had I known that he was in the studio before I played, I wouldn't have been able to play one note.
That's funny. You guys had a ton of hits. Who was the main writers for most of the music?
Most of the hits were written by Rick Roberts. Strange Way, Just Remember I Love You. You Are the Woman, of course, was the biggest hit we ever had.
Right.
That was kind of a blessing and a curse. I mean, you know, hundreds of thousands of musicians and bands would give their eye teeth to have a song that got that big and that much saturation airplay. But the problem with that, with us, was once You Are the Woman came out, Atlantic Records pretty much wanted 10 You Are the Womans per album.
Right.
That's what they wanted to pigeonhole us at. And it was like, oh, that's what you guys are. We want you to be that really ultra soft rock, you know, white bread kind of poppy well-formulated, you know, pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really a rock band who had a lot of blues influences, and Mark Andes and I brought jazzy influences to it, and we from that moment on, from You Are the Woman on, we kind of had a struggle with Atlantic, and they really never wanted to put out any rock singles for us. You know, they only wanted to put out Just Remember I Love You, and now Strange Way is a wonderful song and a great, great song and stuff, but it's still pretty light until, of course, you get to the flute solo on the end.
Right.
So that was kind of the blessing and the curse on that. So,
but
you know, a lot of people who only listened to AM radio thought, oh, Firefall, they're like, of course, Air Supply wasn't around then, but you know how everybody kind of thought, oh, Air Supply. You know, we kind of got pigeonholed into being this really light rock band, but believe me, when we were touring with people like Fleetwood Mac doing Rumors, or the Doobie Brothers, or harder acts like 38 Special and stuff like that, we could rock out with the best of them and hold our own and yet still have all these great songs. So,
well, the interesting thing is that, you know, I remember speaking with David Gates and having him tell me the same thing. First release that they had was Make It With You. The record company said, well, this is what we want from you, even though they had some really rocking songs.
Right.
You know, but again, you get pigeonholed into something that's successful. And it's interesting because I remember Extreme, their big hit was More Than Words. People thought, oh, this is a nice ballad soft rock group. That was like one of the hottest rock groups around.
Well, it's interesting. And, you know, I mean, when you look at Foreigner or REO Speedwagon, they were a rock band who had a lot of rock hits, and then when they finally put out a power ballad or something, like on Foreigner's case, you know, I Want to Know What Love Is,
right.
That ends up being one of their biggest singles ever, and it's a ballad.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe the public loves those love song ballads a lot, but unfortunately for us, and I guess Bread, you know, our first huge hit was the ballad, so we kind of got expected to be just that.
Well, you know what I think it is also? The ballads get played on, like, adult-oriented radio.
Yeah.
And
cross over AM to adult and all to the different genres.
Exactly. So even a song like you know, More Than Words by Extreme, or, you know, You Are the Woman by Firefall is going to be played to audiences that are really older, too.
Right.
On the AOR stations as well.
Well, the one thing that I'm happy to report that is, you know, even back then, but people come see us now, and they may only hear on classic rock radio, You Are the Woman, or Just Remember I Love You Now, you know, and when they come and hear us, I mean, we play You Are the Woman Now as a rock song. We don't play it as a really light pop song, and when we play other songs like So Long or Livin' Ain't Livin', I mean, we have a very powerful drummer, Sandy Ficca, in the band, and we kick it out. Now, we're certainly no heavy metal band or anything, and, you know, no heavy metal band would ever play a song like You Are the Woman, but, you know, we really rock out, and people go away going, God, I didn't realize, A, that they rocked so hard, and B, that they, you know, one of the things we still do, which is rare now, is we're not a real jam band, but we have a lot of guitar solos, and trading off between two lead guitar players, or me and the sax player will trade licks, and we jam a little bit, and have, now as leader of the band, I have really tried to keep the songs that everybody expects to hear. I want those songs to sound as much like the record as we can make them, because really, bands, I really believe, owe their audience a lot, and we all have heard so many artists or bands who maybe only had one hit or two hits, and after 20 years they're so tired of playing it that they change it around and it's virtually unrecognizable, maybe till you get to the chorus.
Right.
And to me, those people are paying 10 or 20 bucks to come in and hear you. They want to hear the songs that they want to hear, their favorite songs. So on songs like You Are the Woman or Just Remember I Love You or Cinderella, we play it just like the record. And, you know, I mean, there may be a few licks different or something, but we really want to keep to the spirit of what it was. And yet, at the same time, on songs like So Long or Livin' Ain't Livin' or Mexico or whatever, and when there's solos happening, we oftentimes go totally new places within the framework of the song or within the chord structure and stuff.
Right.
You know, I can go and play new things that I've never played on a song, you know, on a night now, you know, that I, on a song that I've been playing for 25 years. So that's a really nice balance for me as a musician.
I want to talk about a couple other things, too, because we're running out of time. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, your mom was a musician who taught you music. And I know you have a couple of children. Either of them into the music or arts? Or
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, and my dad was a fine artist, although that once he had a family and had to get a job, he kind of got away from doing artwork. But I got pumped from art from my dad and music from my mom. My two kids, who, my son Jamie, who's 26 now, no, I'm sorry, he's 27, and my daughter, who is a high school senior, Jessica, are both really good artists. And I have been encouraging them and pumping them with art, work, and music since they were infants. And my son Jamie has a band, Portalis, who is, more in the Linkin Park kind of vein. And I don't know what genre you would call that, but he and I are co-producing their new record. And in fact, we were in the studio last night finishing vocals, and we're about to mix in the next few weeks. He was a drummer. I pumped him. He got into drums. You would think that I would have taught him how to play guitar, but he was way into drums. And about 4 or 5 years ago, his band, Portalis, he stepped out and became the lead singer, and the drummer in their band now is the drummer, my Firefall drummer, Sandy's son, Aaron. So Jamie has a band, and we're going to be starting to try to shop for record deals, and they're really good and have really great original songs, and I've been co-producing their record with them, and that's one of Razor Entertainment's projects. My daughter, Jessica, is a rare teenager, a wonderful girl who not only playing clarinet and piano and a little bit of guitar, and she's a really accomplished artist, but she wants to be an astrophysicist, and she has been reading quantum theory and Einstein for about 8 years, you know, so she's like so passionate about anything with astronomy and astrophysics, and she's about to get ready to go into college, and but she's a musician and an artist, and does these wonderful wire sculptures. So
very well-rounded young lady.
Yeah. And in fact, just as an aside, really, I think the only two things that parents absolutely have to give their children is, number one, unconditional love and nurturing and support, and B, I really think that you need to expose them to a lot of different creative stuff, whether it's writing or painting or music or sports or whatever, and you never know what's going to stick, you know, but really be supportive and nurturing in a creative way for them, because I think a lot of people who end up becoming adults who don't think that they can do anything creative, people need outlets, and they need outlets, healthy outlets that come from deep within, and not stuff like, oh, my outlet is drinking, or my outlet is, you know, beating my wife or whatever. You know, outlets like music and writing and painting and poetry and stuff like that is essential for people, even in their spare time, to feel comfortable and confident about doing. And, you know, I'm really blessed as a father with two children that are doing well in that respect.
Now, you also have written, I guess, an instructional video. I have not seen it, but on how to write a song. Is that something you can actually teach people how to write a song? Because I know I write as well, and I think a lot of times it's just something that's inside someone's head, and becomes a release for them. How did you teach someone to write a song?
Well, the first thing that I teach, you know, and I give seminars in Nashville a lot, and Memphis a few times, and some here in Denver, and it's not my groove is not so much just trying to teach songwriting, but how to access childlike creativity. And I'll try to make this brief, but to me, if you go into any first grade class across America and give away crayons and paper, every kid, 100% of the class are artists. They're daring, they're confident, they're proud of their work when they're done. If they mess up, they wad it up and start over again, it's no big deal, or else they turn their mistake into something else. They're this confident, childlike creativity that where they are what they are creating, and it just flows through them. They're like the median. You go back to that same classroom in the fourth grade, and suddenly less than half of the kids can draw anymore, and you're going, what happened? And what it is fear. Fear of, you know, someone saying, oh, that's not any good, or your teacher saying, you know, you should be in gym class instead of art. Or, wow, I don't draw horses as good as Cindy, so I don't think I'll even try. And the older you get, for many people, the further away from that natural childlike creativity adults get. And really, creativity to me, and I know, and I've had many discussions with a lot of people, creativity comes from a very deep place. It's not a left brain thinking kind of thing. You know, and sometimes, you know, if you are right-brained enough and spontaneous and not, first of all, when you sit down to write a song, you know, you got to know going into it that you may fail, you know, maybe less than half of the songs you try to write won't be that great, you know, and that it's not a big deal. And if you've, you know, finished something and it's, you know, it's not what you want, then you go on to the next one, you know. And so many people get hung up into this line or this word or this rhyming scheme or, you know, oh, I got to do this, and they get so left brain about stuff, and they get so critical and analytical and judgmental of what they're creating as it's being created that it's really easy to lose that spontaneous muse. And if you can just kind of turn off the sensor or the judge in your brain, or that little voice that says, you'll never amount to anything, that you heard, you know, maybe when you were a kid or something. If you can turn that off and just let stuff flow through you, then it can get out in a really spontaneous, healthy, almost spiritual way, and then you rewrite it or you look at the rhyme scheme and go, oh, I need to find something better for that line, or I don't like this one chord, one chord in the chord progression, or, you know, then you kind of get really nitpicky and left brain about it, but not during. And pretty much that's what I try to turn people onto the concept of, you know, if you're a good singer and you're trying to write lyrics, you can, maybe not all the time, and every song's different and every situation's different, but if you're a decent singer, if you're right-brained enough and trusting in the muse enough, you can, you know, be playing the chords, you're going to try to write something onto it, and just start singing, and lo and behold, it may happen that four lines of the first verse just pop out and are perfect, and the way you got to them was not by thinking. You know, and I always kind of give the example when Michael Jordan was in his prime and stuff, and you were watching him run a fast break, you know, and he had a defender in front of him, and he had another guy on the wings, and he's going down, and he's going to, you know, he's not thinking about what he's going to do. He's just reacting, and he's just boom, 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 bam, and then he does it, you know, and people, you know, they, well, how'd you do that? And he goes, do what? I don't even remember exactly what it was. Same thing like Stephen King. He just types it all out, you know, and knows that either he later on the computer or his editor can, you know, kind of chop things up and correct spelling or do punctuation. So the last thing I'll say on that is, anybody who's interested out there, I'll give a plug. There's a book out by a woman named Natalie Goldberg, and the name of the book is Writing Down the Bones. And it is so, it's like the creativity Bible. And she said, you know, each chapter is about a page long or a page and a half long, and about chapter 10 or something. She said in one paragraph what took me 20 years of trying to write lyrics, you know, what took me that long to learn on my own. And the way I learned this stuff was by being a really good lead guitar player, because if you listen to the really good players, a Clapton, Steve Morris, Larry Carlton, Carlos Santana, Eddie Van Halen, when those guys are playing, and I think that at times I am good enough to consider myself in that rarefied company. Within the limitations of what you know and what you play, you know, you are so involved in the now that you have no idea what you just played, and you don't even care what you're about to play. You're just playing, and you're just going for it. I think one of the best live solos ever played was Clapton's solo on Crossroads, and it's perfect. And when you later then go kind of do the tablature and figure out, oh, he did this and he repeated this twice and then he went up here and the blah, blah, blah. It's technically perfect, but the way you got to that technical perfection was not through a contrived, slow, left-brained kind of controlled nature. You know, you just let it go. And so anyway, my end of the rap is that if you can, as a songwriter, allow your right brain to go find that collective subconscious and write lyrics. I learned how to write lyrics in 10 or 15 years like I did on solos and stuff. And you can get to a place where if you just start singing, there's a magical moment where things turn into la da 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 from la la's and da da's to actual words, and then suddenly words fall in and there's a line and you go, oh God, that's, wow, there's my title, and boom, here's the chorus, and it just happens real fast, or at least it can. So most people really try to make creativity into this really left-brained, thought-out, totally controlled kind of thing, and in many cases, the best creativity is the opposite of that.
I have to let that be the final words, Jock, because we've run out of time here.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Now, you're a very interesting guy. I wish I had a couple hours to talk to you.
Could I?
Firefall.com is the website, and folks can check it out and get your schedule. And hopefully, one of these days, maybe you'll be doing some more music, some new stuff.
Well, yep, I hope so. In corporate America music world today, it's really hard to get airplay, but we'd love to. I would like to just say one last plug about the guys in the band now. Sandy Fick on drums, Bill Hopkins on bass, Steve Weinmeister lead vocals and guitar, Chris Ball sax, flute, keyboards, and myself have a cooking unit. We love playing the songs. If we play in your area, our calendar's filling up. We'd love to have you come up and say hi and enjoy and sing along and stuff. So thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate the time.
Oh, you're welcome. And again, folks, just go to firefall.com for the schedule, and also they can reach you through there as well, right?
Yes, they can. They can get to personal emails.
Great. All right, thanks,
Jock. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, and we'll talk again sometime.
Okay.
Take care.